Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And with 1 month to go before the budget, what should we all be doing to prepare? Give our money away, stick it in an ISA, use up your full CGT exemption, up your pension contributions, or just leave the country altogether. Simon and Lee have some practical tips, including the old classic, don't panic. Also, a couple of good reader questions about ignoring your father's will and would you remarry your ex to avoid tax? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the number of well-off savers maxing out their 60 grand annual pension contribution has shot up. That's according to both Hargreaves Lansdown and Interactive Investor. While those maxing out their full stocks and shares ISA allowance this year is also up almost a third compared to last year. And millions. And millionaires are leaving the UK in record numbers. It's even prompted the Resolution Foundation to propose an exit tax. The reason? It is, of course, Labour's first budget coming up. So what should and shouldn't we be doing right now? Lee, Simon, welcome. Simon, firstly, what's an exit tax?
An exit tax is something that the Financial Conduct Authority was very keen to stop investment platforms charging on investors recently. But a left-leaning think tank called the Resolution Foundation, it's described as left-leaning. The Resolution Foundation has also got some quite strong links with some senior people in the Labour Party as well. So it's considered to be fairly influential. It's the source of a number of ideas that come bubbling up and may end up being policy. Has said that we should have an exit tax for people leaving the country to take up tax residency elsewhere. And at the moment, say you've got some assets that you've made a big profit on and you would face capital gains tax on them. If you leave the country, you pay no capital gains tax after, if you leave the country for more than 5 years. So basically, if you move your tax residency somewhere else after 5 years, that's it. You don't have to pay CGT on the gains. So you can just take those gains. And you don't have to pay any capital gains tax here. You might have to pay capital gains tax in the country that you've moved to, obviously, but that's not what's the question is being asked about here. Now, they have suggested that we scrap this and adopt a system that other countries have. For example, Australia, Canada, and the US charge some form of exit tax when investors take up fiscal residence in another country. This is not the kind of thing that is going to affect many people. Yeah. There aren't going to be many people leaving the country for tax reasons. The people who do leave the country for tax reasons tend to be very, very wealthy people, or very, very mobile, very highly paid people. So, you know, an example of this would be very senior people kind of working in the private equity industry, where if you're a partner at, you know, one of the private equity firms, or you're high up somewhere at KKR, you could work in London, you could work in Paris, you could work in Frankfurt, you could work in Switzerland, you could work in the US. You know, these people tend to move around, they live in one country for a bit and then they go to another. And many of those people have put down substantial amounts of roots in the UK and in London over the past decade or so. Now there is talk that the mobile element there might decide to up sticks and head elsewhere, depending on what the Labour Party decides to do to their income and their taxes.
Right. I mean, combined, Lee, with the fact that apparently record numbers of millionaires have already left and are leaving, it begs the question, is it really going to be that bad?
Yeah, there's been a lot of noise, a lot of kind of rumours swirling around. I think there's always inevitably going to be when there's been a change of political party. And we've had, you know, 14 years of another political party. So there's always going to be kind of that fear, especially because, you know, you could argue that some of the things that Labour have done in the past have kind of targeted people that are fairly wealthy. So all of these rumors are kind of seeing this, you know, there's been some high profile stories, haven't there, about millionaires that are leaving the country. But
yeah,
some of these people probably already have their holiday homes in Spain and France, and that making that step isn't actually really all that different to how their lifestyle probably is currently. But I'd always argue that just more tax. We've been doing this podcast for a long time, Georgie. Mm-hmm. You know how I feel about just everything being taxed. It's too much. You know, you don't want to have a talent drain, a brain drain of people disappearing out of this country, people that have, you know, made their money from being very smart, doing clever things, setting up businesses, you know, being a real kind of, you know, employing people, that kind of thing. And what do we want to do? Kind of stop people having aspirations to make something of their lives and, you know, really push forward and then end up making a lot of money from hard work and a lot of endeavor. It's just, you could argue that that sort of stifles business. And that's not what we want to see. So, again, this is all based on hearsay, rumours, you know, things that are swirling around. It sounds like that there's a lot on the table. There's a lot being considered. We've obviously had this infamous black hole being rabbited a lot, you know, about the kind of hole in the public finances and how that's going to be plugged. I think a lot of people who chose to vote Labour this time around are kind of looking for services and that kind of thing to improve. I think that's what a large part of what the vote swing was, you know, fed up with the Conservatives, services in their local area haven't improved. Labour are promising that they're going to do this. But every single new government wants to come and say, we're going to fix this, fix that, fix this, that, and the other. You know, whether they can deliver on that is very difficult. So, you know, big exit of millionaires, has it been a bit overblown? You know, is it people that were kind of thinking about doing it anyway? It's hard to really gauge. But for the everyday person, the people that probably listen to this podcast, it's probably not something on the forefront of their mind.
Is it more, Simon? It might be that bad for millionaires, but for most of us, actually, it maybe won't be that bad. And there are things we can do about it.
Well, I think firstly, when we're talking about these figures about millionaires leaving the country, and some of this is based on a report, the Henley Private Wealth Migration Report that came out recently, suggested that we could see a net loss of as many as 9,500 millionaires this year, which is more than double the 4,200 that left last year. These numbers are always very difficult to actually like really accurately put a finger on. But also, I think what we need to remember is that when we're talking about millionaires leaving the country, we're not talking about your common or garden millionaire who just happens to be of a generation where their house plus their savings has pushed them into millionaire status. We're talking about your multi-millionaires, the ones who've made serious money, the ones who are very high earning in certain industries, or entrepreneurs who've built a business, made a load of money. We're talking about those kind of people. And those kind of people have finances that are very, very different to ours, you know, even if we are lucky enough to be amongst the higher earners in this country. So you have to kind of detach those two things from each other, like you said. But I think that the problem perhaps is that Labour were elected on a wave of optimism, whether you voted for the party or not, this idea of change, you know, right, fresh start and everything like that, it was all good. And yes, most people did not expect their taxes to go down under Labour, although the Tories have done a bloody good job of putting many higher earners' taxes up. But they were hoping for some kind of positivity, growth, etc. And we have had 2.5 months of miserabilism and warnings. And there has been no effort to really dampen any of the widespread speculation on every possible tax that could go up, which is why we find ourselves in the position that we are at the moment. Now, amongst all of that speculation, there is obviously, you can find yourself in the position where you feel pressured by it and you feel pressured to do something. I should be doing something. You know, I should act. I should do something now, before the budget. Now, what you have to remember, of course, is that many of those things might not happen. People are very much divided on, for example, pension tax relief. Is that going to change? There's lots of speculation that it might do, but there's speculation ahead of every budget. But there are also some sensible voices saying this is actually really complicated and the knock-on effect of this could be quite substantial. So the Chancellor might be unlikely to do it. capital gains tax. There's lots of speculation that's going to go up to be equal with income tax. But actually raising it by that much might be counterproductive and they might get less in. And if you were going to raise it by that much, you should probably bring back indexation. So maybe they might just put it up by a bit and so on. And what I think people need to do is they need to filter out the where they're feeling pressure to act and they would do things that they might not potentially do anyway from the opportunity to just do some sensible financial planning that they probably should have done by now, or things that they've been putting off, and use this as a catalyst to do it. And those aren't the same thing, because you've got to be very careful about doing something that is that you can't unpick, especially if the thing that you're worried about doesn't actually happen. But if there are certain things that you probably should have been doing anyway, and you look at it and you go, oh God, I wish I'd done that before. Why haven't I done that before? I never get around to doing these things. Well, maybe now, with 1 month to go before the budget, might be a good time to do some of those things, because any changes that you make should fit in with your lifetime financial plan and financial goals and the way that you want your finances to be structured. And it would be a really good idea to have a think about those things before you rush into making any changes.
Okay, well, let's dig into them in more detail. As Simon said, and as if you listened back to last week's podcast with the wonderful Sir Steve Webb, pensions is obviously on people's minds. The reality, Lee, as much as Simon says these things may not happen, as we pointed out then and as we've pointed out over the past few weeks, something needs to happen if we're going to fill this back hole. And the Labour government have sort of hamstrung themselves by the fact they can't raise things like income tax and VAT, etc. So what can you do given what may or may not come down the line? I mean, we've heard, haven't we, recently this week that more people are maxing out their 60,000 annual pension contribution. Well, that would be nice if you can. What are the tips, Lee?
Well, I should start by saying, yeah, excellent podcast last week with Sir Steve. Really good, good listen that, and everything you need to know about pensions was really sort of covered off in that. But you know, really, it goes back to what Simon was saying here. It's all about financial planning, isn't it? And I think what this has actually put into sharp focus is thinking about how generous tax relief is on your pension and why it can really turbo boost your retirement by focusing and saving as much as you possibly can into your private pension because of the tax breaks. Now, as Simon also just pointed out, there's been rumours about this tax relief being cut, being put into a flat rate, 30%, maybe 20%, something along those lines, which would hit higher rate taxpayers and additional rate taxpayers. So the advice there really is to just make sure that you have taken stock of your kind of where your pension is heading. You know, lots of the pension providers offer calculations, forecasts to see where you're going. You know, can you possibly squirrel a little bit more of your salary into your pension, 1%, something like that? Obviously, we're running out of time now because we've got a month until the next budget. So it's going to be difficult really to do much more than, you know, as you say, the £60,000 annual allowance, which went up a couple of years ago from £40,000. If you're lucky enough to be in those, that sort of territory to max that out, you know, it could well worth be doing. You know, that's the sort of thing though that you should probably pay at least one off financial advice for to find out if that is the right option for you. But if you can do it, it doesn't seem like a bad plan. The other thing is the amount of tax that people the amount of cash that people can take out tax free from the pension age 55, which is going up to 57. There's been lots of rumours whether that could be capped at something like £100,000 or 25% of pension pot's value. Again, it's kind of, I don't know if this has triggered a lot of people taking money out or more money than they were possibly planning to do before. But if you're in that boat, it's kind of like you need to have a plan of what you're going to be doing with that money. You know, don't just sort of knee jerk reaction of just taking it out because you think something might happen in the budget next month. But, you know, I think that it always goes into overdrive, Georgie, when it comes to pensions. But it's fiendishly complicated to change. And I think that for that reason, I find it difficult to sort of process very quickly this early on in a new government that they would do something like change pension tax relief. Again, we have no idea. It could happen, but it would be a real big beast to grapple and change.
I would say that there's two places that people need to think about pensions, to echo what Lee said there. Firstly, you need to think about it from the perspective of, are you the person building up a pension? Or also, people need to think about it from the perspective of, are they the person drawing on their pension? Are they in their retirement years? Now, most people listening to this podcast are going to be in the building up their pension years. If you've got a big amount that you plan to pay into your pension for some reason, then it might be worth doing it now. Because pension tax relief is probably not going to change, but it's, if it does change, it's not that likely that it's going to get more generous for most people. It's likely that it might get less generous, or where it really, really matters. So if you're the kind of person who's got that lump sum that they could put into your pension, mm-hmm. you're probably more likely to be a high earner. And in fact, actually, you can only pay as much into your pension and benefit from the tax relief as you earn from income in that year. So if you wanted to max out 60 grand, you'd need to be earning 60 grand in that year. So you would be a higher rate taxpayer. Now, the thing is the biggest difference is going to be if you're going to pay in a big lump sum, that will be where it makes the big difference. And there are people who do this. Now, a classic example is self-employed people. Self-employed people, I'm going to make a sweeping generalization here, but are terrible at paying into their pensions. There is a temptation to roll up the money within your business, whether you're a sole trader or you work as a limited company, and then the pension situation is slightly different because effectively, if you pay into your pension as a limited company, you can pay in as the employer or you can pay in as the employee. But even sole traders tend to roll that money up. They put it aside for tax. They put it in aside for if they need it for the business and so on and so on. And they can end up with quite large cash balances. And then someone says to them, have you paid any money to your pension? They're like, no, I didn't have enough money to do that. And it's like, well, maybe you should put some of that money in there. So you do get this scenario where sometimes they do pay in large lump sums, or someone might have suddenly come in some money or something like that. So maybe if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you've got a big lump sum to pay in, maybe do it now. If you're just talking about your regular contributions into your pension from your earnings, or you're just your monthly contributions and so on, I wouldn't really worry about it. The major effect of any reduction in pension tax relief would be a long term sort of drain on the growth that you would get from that tax-free pension saving. And actually, if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you might even get more. Then looking at the people in retirement, there's the lump sum thing, as Lee said. It's very tempting for people to take their 25% lump sum because they're worried about it. Again, Steve said on the podcast last week, highly unlikely that they would absolutely raid the lump sum, but you never know. But what are you going to do with it? Because once you take it out, if it's in cash and you just have it in a normal savings account, you're going to pay tax on the interest. If you put it into a normal investment account, you're going to pay tax on capital gains and dividends. You can put some of it into an ISA, but you can only put £20,000 in this year. Whereas within the pension, your money is protected from dividend tax, from capital gains tax. It can grow free of those taxes, and then you're only taxed when you take it out. The other area that there's talk about that might change is the inheritance benefits of a pension. Pensions sit outside of your estate. If you die before 75, you can pass it on tax-free. If you die after 75, the person taking the money out will pay tax at their marginal rate. And if it's a fairly large pension, that means it gets added to their income and they might end up paying 40% or even 45% tax on it anyway. So it might not be that inheritance tax beneficial. If you're under 75, it is inheritance tax-free at the moment. They might change that. But what are you going to do about it? I wouldn't recommend dying before the budget just to take advantage of the inheritance tax benefits. I would, as I said, just, you know, if you were going to do some things anyway, maybe do them now if it's beneficial to you. But otherwise, sit back, relax, don't panic.
Lee, Simon mentioned there about putting money into ISAs. Obviously, that 20 grand limit, but that's probably a good little tip for general, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. And this year has been an absolute glut of ISA saving. I mean, people have really filled the coffers. Something like 40-odd billion pounds has flowed into ISAs this year. That £20,000 shelter is crucial for people. And actually, there are a lot of people out there that don't take advantage of it, that could full well take advantage of that full £20,000 limit, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in that boat, and fantastic. But you know, they have become very, very much in vogue the last 12 to 18 months. You know, we've spoken about this on the podcast before, the savings tax on interest and your personal savings allowance. Many more people are breaching that. It's expected to claw in more than £10 billion for the Treasury. And that's how many people are getting sort of caught out into that trap. A lot of that can be navigated by simply saving into an ISA. That £20,000 limit is very generous. Could that get cut in the budget for the next financial year? I mean, again, nothing's...
Well, anything's
Everything's on the table. And our friends we were talking about at the start of the show, the Resolution Foundation, did a huge paper a few months ago about capping ISAs at £100,000, and you can't save any more into them. So, you know, things like that are definitely bubbling away behind the scenes. And I would say, if you haven't already, take full advantage of that allowance, if you can, as much of it as you can, because it shields your money, your savings from the taxman.
Simon, I want to talk to you about capital gains. I mean, it's been cut to the bone anyway, the allowance. I mean, what more could happen? I mean, you mentioned there, perhaps bring it up in line with income tax levels. What, again, what should you be doing?
This is the big speculation. Capital gains tax is almost certain that something's going to happen with it. It will be seen as a relatively easy and painless target, because not that many people actually end up paying capital gains tax, although the numbers for that are going to go up substantially due to the fact that Jeremy Hunt, in his wisdom, halved the capital gains tax allowance from £12,300 to £6,000 and then halved it again the following year. So the amount of profits that you can make tax-free, the allowance, you know, has gone from over £12,000, and that hadn't budged with inflation, down to £3,000. So it's going to pull a lot more people into it. Then when you make those profits, you pay a lower rate of tax on them than you would do if you took the money as income. This has long been blasted as a unfair situation, and that people should pay the same amount as income. There's two sides to this argument. One is, you know, it just enables people to, very rich people in some cases, to lower their tax rate. The other one is that people are taking some form of risk, be it investment risk, entrepreneurial risk, and so on, in order to make capital gain. And it's not the same as the sort of guaranteed income that you get from employment. But it is a target. Whether they would put them up, as I said earlier, to it be in line with income tax rates is debatable, because there's lots of data on changing capital gains tax rates from this country and around the world. And you can see what happens when you do. And if you put them up a little bit, the government gets more money. If you put them up by a lot, people then don't sell, because they go, well, there's no point in me selling, I pay so much in tax, even though they actually, you know, still make a profit. And so then you see the tax take, you know, potentially come down, even though the tax rate is higher. So you're better off putting them up by a little bit. And if you were to put them up to income tax levels, arguably you should bring back indexation, so only profits above inflation are taxed. And that would be much more complicated. In fact, that wouldn't be a terrible idea. So if you do have capital gains that you've made of more than £3,000, it would probably be a wise idea to maybe consider taking some of those. At the moment, if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you pay 10% above the allowance. If you're a higher rate or additional rate taxpayer, you pay 20%. And if it's residential property, you'd pay 18 or 24%. So that's basically if it's a buy-to-let. But let's talk about shares and investments for the time being. This is where there are quite a lot of people who get caught out. They could have shares or investments outside of an ISA that they've held for quite a long time. They could have share save schemes from old employment or their current employment, which can build up to a tidy sum of money. They could have shares that they were given as a kid. We had an Ask an Expert question recently from someone who had £12,000 worth of BAE shares. They hadn't got the faintest idea who'd given them to them or when, but they knew that it was about 30 years ago. And how on earth did they work out their capital gain? It could also be crypto. And yes, you do have to pay tax on your crypto profits. And there will be people out there sitting on maybe a nice £5,000, £10,000, maybe even more of Bitcoin profits. So you should potentially consider using the £3,000 allowance and taking some of those profits now, or at least before April, so that you can then get a bit of profit tax free, and then next year you can use your allowance. Ideally, if you've got profits outside of an ISA, you want to be using that allowance each year to try to take the money. And you can sell those investments and then you can buy them straight back within an ISA through a process called a bed an ISA. Whereas you can't sell them and buy them straight back outside of an ISA, you have to wait 30 days. So if it's shares, funds, investment trusts, and you've got the ISA allowance available, crystallize the profits now up to the tax-free allowance, reinvest back within an ISA, job done. You might also think, maybe if I've got big profits, I should take some of them now and just pay 20% tax on them or 10% tax on them, rather than wait till after the budget when I might be paying a higher tax rate. But again, the changes might not materialize. The difficulty is that what do you do about crypto? So say you've made those Bitcoin profits. Do you cash those in order to take some of the tax-free allowance or even to pay a lower tax rate on them? But then you can't buy that back within an ISA. You would have to wait 30 days in order to buy the crypto back under the CGT rules. And if there is something where a lot can happen to the price in 30 days, it's definitely crypto. So that's a more complicated one for people. But I think what people have to consider with capital gains tax is it's very unlikely that it's going to get more generous at any level, whether you're a basic rate taxpayer or a higher rate taxpayer. And again, to go back to what I said earlier, this is actually just good financial planning that you should be doing anyway. And, you know, full disclosure, I've been caught out by this in the past. And, you know, having had sums of investments that were outside of ISAs that I should have put into ISAs, I didn't put them into ISAs. I didn't worry about it so much. Capital gains tax limit was quite high, but there was a period of time between moving houses when I lumped a load of money into investments, which is not really a wise strategy, just to be clear for people, but I was happy to take the high risk. And then I was like, oh, damn it. But there are some things you can do. You can transfer assets to your spouse if you have one, and that's tax-free. So you could split the gains across the two of you. So if you've got a big gain and your partner, your spouse or your civil partner doesn't have any gains, you could transfer some of those assets to them and then you can both sell up and you can double up the tax-free amount.
All right then, Simon, just quickly, another area which has been cut to the bone by the Conservatives, how much worse can it get? Dividends. I mean, should you, if you're self-employed, should you take them now?
Yeah, so this is a difficult one. Dividends, the dividend allowance is now only £500 per year. If you're an investor, you have no control over when your dividends are going to be paid. It's the company paying the dividends that controls that. If you're self-employed, though, and you pay yourself through dividends, some of your income or all of your income, then you do actually have control over that. And it may potentially be worth you taking some of that dividend income now in case those dividend rates rise, because the dividend rates are lower than they are for normal income tax. And that might be a potential example of somewhere where they decide to equalize the tax rates. Again, before you make any big decisions on this, if we're talking about serious sums of money, I would recommend getting some, you know, qualified financial advice for your personal situation, because you don't want to make the wrong decision in order to try to save yourself money and end up costing yourself more money in the long run.
Well, we'll get on to the potential wrong decisions, but just finally, Lee, inheritance. Should you be flying business class?
What do you mean?
Not leaving the country, but like just spending your money, giving it away.
Before the budget, sort of buy a couple hundred thousand pounds worth of flights and cruises to try and get rid of all of your cash. Or as Simon said earlier, you know, don't die before the budget. No. Just trying to avoid any changes that might come. So there's been loads of rumours around what might and might not happen in terms of inheritance tax. Again, it's a kind of case of don't make rash decisions. You know, we're going to talk about what some of those rash decisions could be in a sec. But, you know, what you can be doing right now is something that we were talking about a little while back on the podcast, and that is to be using the various gift allowances that are around If you're in that position, you know, £3,000 annual gift you could make to children, grandchildren, relatives, that kind of thing, it could be well worth thinking about. And actually, I think, did you know what, Georgia? Why don't we spin it into now what things that you shouldn't do? We wrote with kind of Hargreaves Lansdown with their help and some of the things that you shouldn't be doing. And talking about an inheritance tax point of view, and one of the things I think that there is a temptation to do sometimes from people is that, especially in London and the Southeast, lots of property values have ticked over the inheritance tax threshold. And I think people kind of go, well, what should we do with this property now to avoid a massive bill down the line? And if there's trying to give your property away, but you're still in there, sometimes it can crop up within families. You know, what you should do is you should sign the house over to me now, and you know, there won't be tax to pay on it and all that kind of stuff because you've got a 7-year rule, etc. etc. But it can become incredibly complicated if you start doing that, and it could be the wrong decision. So you really need to think carefully if that's something that you've been thinking of doing, because there might be some changes afoot in the budget that's coming up. So that's one I would link in there, that Hargreaves were kind of sort of warning against here. Signing over a property to children probably on the whole isn't the greatest move, and also giving away money that you can't afford to give away. So if you are thinking about gifting money and you think you're kind of awash with cash and you might be property rich, now don't shoot yourself in the foot because you feel like you've got to strip all this money away and give it away. And it sounds like a lovely headache, but for actually a lot of people that find themselves in this boat, there's nothing that drives and divides families more than money, and the way that it's kind of handed out. So definitely don't give away money that you can't afford to do. Another one that they've got here is to think about taking equity release on a property. Now, people think that they can avoid inheritance tax by sort of taking the money out and giving it all away. Again, 7-year rules come into effect here. Again, you've got it feels like now, if that was something that was on your mind, there's not long to really make such a massive decision between now and the budget. So I think that are some of the sort of inheritance tax planning things that you've got to be super careful of. And again, you know, if in doubt, it's always worth paying for one-off financial advice to think about this. And if it's things that are giving you financial headaches, and just going back to the pension stuff as well, you got to be careful when you start tinkering around with your pension and taking money out of it, because if you do, you will trigger the money purchase annual allowance, which will slash the amount of money that you can pay into your pension from that moment onwards. So who that affects is people that perhaps 55 take the money out and then are still in employment and might still be in employment for a relatively long amount of time. You've then kind of again shot yourself in the foot because you can't save anywhere near as much as what you could have done before you've triggered that. So little bits and pieces in this Hargreaves sort of piece that they help with us. Five things that they said that you should be thinking about, sensible planning steps ahead of the budget, very simple stuff. Number one is make a pension contribution. You know, it's what we were talking about earlier, just making sure that you feel like you're putting enough away in your pension. And if there's one thing, if there's one sort of silver lining about all of this budget chat, I do think it has put it into sharper focus, and people are kind of more like, wow, okay, pension, private pension really is the way to save for retirement. Paying to an ISA, we were just talking about that. Take out a junior ISA for a child. Again, you know, if you're someone that is worried about inheritance, you know, you could always encourage grandparents, for example, to be tucking some money away into a junior ISA for your child. You know, I think that's quite an easy way in to start, if you are sort of looking to give away a bit of your wealth. Use a bed and ISA for existing investments. I'm sure Simon will talk to you about that in a sec. And use your capital gains tax allowance on share gains. Again, I know that Simon will want to talk through those, but just five simple things that you could be thinking about. But again, it is just about don't panic, don't make rash decisions. Really think about what it is that you're doing, and remember that lots of these rumored changes might not materialize.
I think the inheritance tax thing is somewhere where it ties in very closely with what we were talking about doing some financial planning in itself. Inheritance tax is a big worry for lots of people, and inheritance tax is a very hated tax, but there isn't actually that many estates that fall into the net. Potentially, there could be changes that are made that increase the number of estates that fall into the net. For example, there's speculation they might remove the own home allowance. Personally, if I was the Chancellor, I'd be careful about doing anything with a tax that's dubbed Britain's most hated, just because of the sentiment around it. You know, an inheritance raid never looks good. And that £1 million that you can give away maximum as a married couple hasn't changed, you know, in a long time. What they might do is some stuff around the reliefs that the much more high value estates take advantage of. The ones that manage to start to substantially reduce the sort of percentage of tax on the overall estate. Things like agricultural relief, where if it's farmed land, you can give that away free of inheritance tax, business property relief. There's talk about doing it with the AIM shares thing. But there are potential knock-on effects for all of these things. There's big concerns that if they were to remove the inheritance tax benefits of holding AIM shares, that it could sink the AIM small cap market. There is concern that if they were to do some of the business stuff, it could harm families who genuinely have built up businesses over the years, and it could end up with that business is passed on but then has to be sold or broken up. The agricultural relief was designed genuinely for farmers to stop people having to break up the family farm when, you know, the owner died and it was passed on to the son, the nephew, the grandson, the granddaughter, you know, whatever. The knock-on effect would be potentially that rich people don't get to dodge inheritance tax so much, but that it becomes even harder for farmers in this country and people start losing family farms. And, you know, go watch Clarkson's Farm for an example kind of thing of how difficult it is for farmers right now. But, you know, as he makes the point, I am independently very, very rich. And there are lots of farmers out there who may be asset rich, but they are not independently very, very rich. And it would end up with the breakup of the farms. Things lower down the scale they might do is they might tighten up some of the stuff around gifting. That would be a strange thing to do, because actually some of those rules are so outdated that actually you need to be able to give away more money, not less money. And it would be very foolish to start reducing some of those things or lengthening the 7-year rule, for example, when actually the suggestion of the Office of Tax Simplification's report that was never acted on was to shorten the 7-year rule. But if you are in the position where you know that your estate is going to get hit by inheritance tax, or you're in the position where you know your grandparents or your parents' estate is going to get hit by inheritance tax, and you are agreed that you would rather minimize that, because there are two ways of looking at this. You could just look at it as, I'll be dead, I don't care, and it's tax that goes into the pot and I'm very lucky and that's fine. Or you could look at it as, actually, do you know what, I paid quite a lot of tax over my life in terms of my income, on my savings, on my investments, on all these other things, and I would like to be able to give what I can to my family tax-free. Then if you are in that position where you want to do something about it, you need to start doing something about it. Seek specialist advice if you need to, but also start giving that money away. Those allowances every year, it's not a cap on what you can give away. It's just if you give away more than that, you have to survive 7 years for it to be outside of the IHT net. And I don't need to really state the obvious that the sooner you start doing that, the better. There is the ability to give away surplus income. If you want to learn more about that, go back a couple of podcasts. We talked about it in detail. But if you've got surplus income and you make regular gifts, then you could start, for example, paying into an ISA for children or grandchildren, paying into a pension for them, helping out with the cost of various things. If you do want to give money for a house deposit or something like that, you know, maybe consider doing it. But again, don't give away more money than you should be giving just because you're worried about something happening that may not happen. And the other thing you need to bear in mind is stuff around care costs. Mm-hmm. And do you need to keep some money aside for that in case you need to go into care in later life? They are very expensive. And that, again, is a complicated scenario. And what you also need to avoid doing is if you do look like you're going to need to go into care, you can't just give all your money away now in order to avoid care costs, because you'll get in trouble for that.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Rob, we've got a reader question here. I want to invest in the UK stock market. What are the best options to do so?
So there's lots of ways you can invest in the UK market. You can buy shares of individual companies listed here in the UK through your stocks and shares ISA or investment account, for instance. And this approach allows you to select specific companies you believe could perform well. But for broader, simpler exposure, you could buy a stake in the whole market via what's called an exchange-traded fund or ETF. And these aim to perform in line with the market, the FTSE 100, or more commonly the FTSE All Share, which is a broader index that includes medium-sized and smaller companies. And typically, they do this by holding shares in the constituent companies in the index. So essentially, you're buying the whole market through buying one share. So it's an easy, simple way to buy in. And there's also funds that do a similar thing. They're also passively managed so that they simply aim to track rather than beat the market. And then there's actively managed funds that specialize in UK shares too, that do try and beat the performance of the market. And these are managed by professional fund managers who select stocks based on their research and analysis. And they tend to come with higher charges as a result, but hopefully a good manager can sometimes have an edge and provide a superior return. Similarly, investment trusts are companies listed on the London market that invest in other companies. And some of these specialize in the UK market too. And they often have a particular focus, such as producing dividend income or focusing on one specific area like smaller companies. So lots and lots of options to consider.
And how much of a portfolio should be UK focused?
The UK market is small in the grand scheme of things. It's 4% of global stock markets, but it probably does punch above its weight in terms of the variety of companies on offer. A strictly globally weighted approach would mean allocating only a small amount to the UK, but it's probably right that investors here in the UK consider a bit of home bias and support our UK listed companies and stock market. There's also a good reason, I think, at present, with quite depressed valuations, to particularly consider UK companies. And there's a market yield, so the dividend income produced by the market, at almost 3.5%. So you're generally well paid to hold UK stocks, even though the growth prospects might not be as good as other markets overall. So bearing all this in mind, I think a weighting of 10 or 20% to the UK is perfectly fair. Maybe a bit more if you're particularly bullish on the cheapness of the market and the opportunities, especially from an income perspective. But it really comes down to personal preference and outlook.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Reader's question time. We'll set the budget aside for another week or so. But we have some good ones here. Well done, lads, for picking these. The first one, I have a very sensitive question about whether I can ignore certain parts of my father's will that I see as cruel or unfair. Now, this reader says their father was a kind and loving man, but also a product of his time. They are the executor of the will, and there are a couple of sections that they want to ignore. One is that he has asked that his dog, a six-year-old Labrador called Alfie, close your ears, Petal, be put down. His reasoning is that the dog will be bereft and won't want to live without him. Another is that he wants certain drawings made by his father to only be kept by the men of the family. His thinking is that if they're left to women, they could remarry and the drawings would leave the family. I object to both points strongly. Do I legally have to respect his wishes? Lee Boyce, who wants to put a dog down? I think my dog loves me. But she'll move on if I die. You know, I'm not going to take her life away because she's going to be so bereft without me.
Georgie is currently showing me her chewed up slipper from her dog at the moment.
Going on eBay.
I think there's so much around wills. Listen, at least the person's left the will. At the end of the day, a lot of people don't leave a will or don't have one that's properly kind of coherent. You know, this is very sort of like, I want this, I want that to happen. Mm. Now, the thing is, first of all, in the dog scenario, I mean, 6 years old is a very young dog. It feels very cruel going down a dog of that age. I can kind of understand that you might be worried about who might have the dog. You know, it might be that you don't want to put on your children or a family member and you think, you know, they don't particularly like dogs or wouldn't be able to care or cope with the dog. The second part is just absolutely ridiculous. And that's something like you kind of read out of a 19th century kind of, you know, novel that the paintings might leave the family. I mean, it's just quite bonkers, really. So the good news on this is you can ignore certain parts of a will. There's grounds in which you can do that. You can ignore bits that are immoral, illegal, or impossible. Now, I love that. I reckon there's some real impossible things that get asked to sort of well. So if you think about it, the three I's, I would call them, from the will here. Is it impossible to put the dog down? No. Is it illegal to put the dog down? No. Is it immoral to put the dog down? I think there is a very big yes. And for that reason, that you would almost certainly get away with not putting the dog down out of this will. There was a famous case in France of French film star Alain Delon, who asked for his dog to be put down and buried with him when he died. Now, that would be deemed... The expert we have here, Lisa Flaherty from Anderson Strathern, who's an associate there, says that it would be very likely to be judged to be immoral here in the UK for that to happen. And again, when they're saying, she says here that there have been also been cases where someone left money to a relative in the will, but on condition that they marry a person of their choice, a divorce, the current spouse. Both could definitely be considered immoral. A fairly common request that could be considered reasonable, though, is leaving a house to a family member, but only if they agree to live in it. Some may argue that this is immoral, but there could be justifications, such as when a house has been in the family for many generations. What you can read into it from that is that the immoral part of this is an incredibly grey area, but you could quite easily argue the two things in this will to be immoral. So it's very, very unlikely that you would need to go through with it and do it. But it does raise a question then of what are you going to do with the dog? You know, you're going to need to put it up for adoption. You know, it might have to go to a rescue centre, because if you don't want the dog and you have no emotional attachment to it, you know, that's the road that you might go down. It does, and I can understand it. I think that this will was possibly not fantastically written, in terms of it's probably more that this person wants to make sure that this dog wouldn't have a rubbish life after they passed away, as in mistreated, because they put this is, it sounds bizarre, but this is probably out of love of thinking that no one could possibly look after or love this dog as much as I have. But there's a lot of families out there that will go to rescue centers and take dogs and pets on. I mean, look, I've got a cat, and I went and rescued the cat from a rescue center back in 2016, so 8 years ago. One of the best decisions that I've ever made, actually, because the cat, you know, it had a rough start of life, rough couple of years, had a couple of kittens, was found abandoned by some garages. And as soon as I went into this rescue center, the cat made a beeline for my wife and I, and we were like, that's the cat we want. And we're now 8 years into having the cat, and she's an absolutely amazing cat. So, you know, it's kind of like, pets can always go and have another lease of life. And I think whoever's written this will has been quite short-sighted, and you could easily say that this is immoral.
I don't want to speak badly of the dead, but I can't even imagine. Like, honestly, I can't even. And I actually had to Google then whether it's illegal to put down a healthy dog. In the US, yes. In the UK, no. But it's down to the vets, I suppose, to decide whether they're willing to carry something like that out. But just the idea is abhorrent to me. Anyway, talking about things that might be abhorrent to me, can't even imagine this. Could, would, should you remarry your ex to avoid tax? Right. So this is the reader's question. My husband and I divorced amicably in 2021. We both still live in the marital home worth about £600,000, which they have unofficially converted into two flats. They also own the two flats that they each owned when they met in 2000, and they're worth about £300,000 each and are currently being rented out. All of that is in joint names. Are you still with me? So anyway, they continue. We agreed upon divorce to transfer ownership of the flats back to the original owner, but had just not got round to sorting out the paperwork for this. How do we go about this? Are there tax implications? And if so, would getting remarried temporarily be a way to get this sorted more cost-effectively? I mean, to me, that sounds sort of a mental leap to get to the remarriage bit. And there must be all sorts of other issues to consider about getting remarried. Simon, good question, though.
It's a great question, isn't it? And I must admit that when this was filed, I said to Harvey, who did the question and got the experts to answer it, I was like, Harvey, did someone genuinely send us this question? He's like, yes, of course they did. He's like, I wouldn't make something like
that. Yeah, you can't make that up. Yeah.
It is astonishing, but it does highlight how people can end up tying their finances in a bit of a knot. Ironically, the financial knot that has been tied here stems from the original knot of marriage, but then the fact that the couple have remained amicable since and got divorced. And if the divorce hadn't have been so amicable and they hadn't have been so easygoing, they probably would have sorted this all out before now. But they haven't. And now they want to sort it out. And they've discovered that actually they will end up with a capital gains tax liability when they start passing these properties backwards and forwards. And the scenario is that your main residence is free of capital gains tax, but other properties incur capital gains tax. And when you transfer a property from one name to another, you trigger a capital gains tax liability. And this happens when people think, well, can't I just give my son or daughter the flat? And it's like, well, you can just give them it, but there are some things that come into play here. One, you crystallize the capital gain and you're going to have to pay some tax, even if they don't give you any money for the flat. And two, going back to our inheritance tax point before, it counts as, you know, you're giving this away. Inheritance isn't an issue here, but capital gains is. And without going too much into the complications, basically, if they're selling the flats that are rented out, capital gains tax would be applicable when they sell them. If they pass one property to the other, capital gains tax would be applicable. Their main marital home, even though they're not married, should be free of capital gains tax if they were to both decide to sell it. And depending on how they pass these things around would depend on the levels of tax and the tax on the various properties incurred. If they were to remarry, in theory, a lot of this problem would go away, apart from the elements where potentially they want to sell the investment properties and cash in the gains. But if they don't sell them and they just keep hold of them and keep collecting the rent, then that wouldn't be a problem. That then raises the question of, can you just remarry to avoid tax? This is something that HMRC would potentially scrutinise. Whether it's actually technically illegal or not is a grey area, and you can choose to marry anyone you want to. It is illegal to have a sham marriage for immigration purposes. And again, as I said, you know, just because something isn't illegal doesn't mean that HMRC wouldn't heavily scrutinise it. And they might find that they've decided that you owe this tax. And it is the kind of area where if you were going to do anything like this or investigate anything like this, you need to obviously ask yourself the moral question around the, do I just remarry in order to do this? But also ask yourself the legal and proper financial questions of, is what I'm planning to do even legal and even going to work? Which is where a seeking individual advice from a qualified tax specialist, financial advisor, or someone who can give you the definitive answers comes into play.
There are also other, I'm just thinking about any tax advisor going, yeah, crack on. There are also other considerations. Should one of them die while they're still married, wouldn't all of their, unless they've updated their wills and stuff, wouldn't there be all sorts of things, you know, they might not want their inheritance to go to their partner and all sorts of other issues that may arise from the fact that they are married again?
This is true. And in fact, actually, They should have updated their wills when they got divorced. They may not have updated their wills when they got divorced. They may not even have wills. If they do have wills, they should have updated them when they got divorced. And if they remarried again, they should update them again. It does highlight, though, actually, if you are on such good terms with your ex that you continue to live in the same property, even if you've converted it into two flats, and there would be substantial financial benefits to you getting married. Happy to continue in the scenario where you both live in the same property and you rub along well and you obviously get along so well. It's a, you know, a platonic relationship. Should you just get remarried anyway?
I mean, look, who am I? This is not a dating or relationship podcast, but I will just bring in the situation of my parents, who have been divorced for about, 20 years or something. I mean, after that initial sort of dodgy time, they spend all the time together. Every Christmas, they hang out with the grandkids. They're as amicable as you could get. Do they want to get remarried? They do not want to get remarried. So that's all I will say there. And I don't think they'd even do it for.
I think this is more of an issue for couples who are living together and have children who are unmarried. I think this is where it is more beneficial. I wouldn't suggest getting back with your ex and remarrying your ex. I just think you're asking for trouble.
Yeah.
But if you are living together in a long-term relationship and you haven't married, and particularly if you have children and you have assets, then it is likely to be highly beneficial to you to get married. And you should probably consider it, even if you just nip down the registry office and don't tell anyone.
All right.
I would seriously say that anybody in that position should possibly, you know, consider it, because there are substantial benefits to it. And whether you think that's fair or not is just the state of play.
Right. All right then, Simon.
Because I don't think it's fair. Personally, I actually think that there should be better rights for long-term couples who aren't married. But unfortunately, the state of play is that there is not that situation. So, you know, in my mind, if I was in that position, I probably would seriously consider getting married.
Wow.
Even if I didn't tell anyone other than my spouse. Wow. Your spouse will have to find out that you've married them.
Generally.
No, I think they do. I think that's one of the legal bits.
They have to be compos mentis. Right, Simon, before I let you go, your stat of the week. Do you have a good one for me?
Stat of the week is actually two stats. Mm-hmm. NVIDIA. Most people know what NVIDIA is. Mm-hmm. AI, chip maker, US stock market darling, shares massively on the rise. NVIDIA shares are up 157.5% this year, which is astonishing.
Decent, yeah.
But there's another company that you might not have heard of that is also listed on the US stock market, and it's up by even more. And that is Vistra Corporation. And Vistra Corporation shares, as of a substantial recent rise, are now up 199.87% year to date. So that's as near as, damn it, 200%.
Wow. I like those stats. Thank you very much, Simon. All right, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like this podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.